from WCVB Channel 5 Podcasts and SportsCenter 5. It's Take 5 with Chris Gasper.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this edition of the Take 5 podcast. Today's guest, Nicole Auerbach of The Athletic. She's here to talk about the seismic change in college sports. July 1st was Liberation Day for scores of college athletes. Now they can capitalize on their talent, just like other college students, by being able to market themselves through name, image, and likeness rights. About 24 states have already passed their own NIL laws, so right now it's a patchwork. The NCAA had to react to that and open everything up. We talked to Nicole about how this will allow some Olympic athletes, people like Katie Ledecky, who had to stop competing in the NCAA in order to be able to make money. Well, now they won't have to do that anymore. They won't have to sacrifice their earning power. Also, what's the future of the NCAA now with the model changing to a point where it's not really recognizable? Will the NCAA still exist in 10 years? We asked Nicole that. And also, Ellen, Nicole told us about something we didn't know about. Olivia Dunn, this gymnast for LSU, is very, very popular. She has more than 1 million Instagram followers. She's been able to capitalize right away on these new NIL rules. And in part, this is because of something that Nicole told us, something called the Gymternet. Have you ever heard of this?
I guess I never heard of it in that exact term, but I have fallen into the Instagram hole of watching gymnasts just compete over and over again. It's something you can't turn your mind off of. It is so amazing.
Yeah. And I think it's so great too, because one of the fears in the beginning of this was that this would only further enhance the disparity and divide between some of the quote unquote revenue sports like college basketball and college football and some of the Olympic sports like gymnastics or tennis or golf. And I think it's great to see right out of the jump that some of these Olympic athletes are marketable. And I know you feel pretty strongly that this should also help when it comes to things like gender equity.
As a man, it's much easier to make a living in sports, playing sports. They are the most profitable, obviously, of the sports. Don't even get me started into the U.S. Olympic soccer teams, okay? So it's nice to know that these women can use their followings to promote themselves in whatever way that they want to promote themselves. We talk about on the podcast if this could potentially hurt women athletes in the way that they might be sexualized. And it's really, I think, up to them how they want to be portrayed on their own social media platform. It's nice to know that they can create a living from this past college.
It's a great point. And for a lot of these athletes, their most marketable years will be college. And to your point about female athletes, I think about an athlete like Jenny Finch, the former softball player at Arizona. She had no control really over how she was marketed and how people sort of marketed her. And now this generation's Jenny Finch can decide how she wants to be marketed. Does it want to be from an aesthetic standpoint? Does it want to be from an athletic standpoint? Ideally, it's from both standpoints if that's what that athlete desires. So this is major, major progress. We're talking about not evolution, but a revolution in college sports. We do that with Nicole Auerbach of The Athletic. She's next.
Hey, Boston, let's talk sports. WCVB Sports Center 5, The Contact.
Source at MLB tells me.
Expert analysis.
That's going to be a major point of contention.
On air.
I talked to a high-ranking source.
And exclusive articles free on the WCVB app. Duke Castiglione, Chris Gasper, Bob Halloran, and special correspondent Mike
Once
Lynch.
Again,
the strongest team covering Boston's teams.
The only game in town.
WCVB Sports Center 5 on Boston's news leader.
All right. Now, as promised, we're joined by Nicole Auerbach of The Athletic. She covers college sports for The Athletic. Nicole, thanks for joining us here on the Take 5 podcast.
Yeah, happy to be reunited with an old buddy.
Yeah, that's right. So I remember when Nicole was an intern at the Boston Globe, when I worked at the Globe, and you could tell she was going places fast, and she definitely has, and she has now far exceeded my career. So it's great to have her, and a few years back, we were able to reunite at the Olympics as well, so she also covers Olympic sports. So when are you going to Tokyo?
I'm not going.
No,
I'm going to have some severe FOMO, but I'll probably chime in on some swimming stuff from home. So.
Fantastic.
I'll be there in spirit.
That's, I'm sure Katie Ledecky will miss you greatly.
She probably will. Mom and I really bonded.
I know. You've written so many great stories on her. But we want to talk to Nicole, obviously, about what has happened in college sports. I think that there has been a seismic change starting July 1st. Now, suddenly, college athletes, Nicole, are able to leverage their name, image, and likeness to be able to make money. This really takes away at what has been the bedrock of the NCAA's model, which is the idea of amateurism, the idea that these student athletes, as the NCAA calls them, can't really monetize their own ability or their own popularity. So how significant is this change for college sports?
Well, it is seismic because, like you said, this was a bedrock. This was part of the foundation of the system. They've always said that people love college sports because they're playing for the purity of the sport and teamwork, and that they just love to do this. And they're doing it for something greater than themselves and not money. It's so different than professional athletes. Like, literally one of their defenses in court has been that people like college sports better because they know that the athletes are not paid. Okay. So like, this is part of how this thing works. And so, although this is not salaries, this is not paying them for play, it is still allowing them to make money and still retain eligibility. So this is huge. I mean, think about a lot of the major scandals in, you know, NCAA rule violations. It's been about stuff like this. It's literally Johnny Manziel's signing autographs and being paid for them. It's, you know, getting, a couple hundred bucks, you know, as because you're doing a good job. I mean, it's all because they don't have this opportunity. They didn't have an opportunity to get $1,000 to do a sponsored Instagram post. So, you know, if the only way that they could, you know, have anything and they need spending money or they want money to send home is to, you know, handshake with a booster for a couple hundred dollars. Like, that's where we've had so many scandals over the years. The Ohio State scandal about tattoos.
Terrell Pryor.
Of who they are. Yeah, that's exactly what NIL would be, right? Like, that they could just get a tattoo, promote the tattoo parlor, and get it for free. Like, that would be allowed, okay? So it's that's why it's really seismic, because if you think about, A, where there's been a lot of so-called scandals in the past, and B, just, again, this idea that they can make some money while retaining eligibility when it doesn't have anything to do. They're not being paid. Like, they're not being paid per touchdown. They're not being paid for these things, but acknowledging that other athletes, in outside of the college sports model, or, you know, a musician on campus she could run a camp, an equivalent, whatever, like a, you know, series of lessons or whatever it might be, and make money for that, where athletes can't. Like, it wasn't the same. You want to say student athlete, but they weren't getting the same privileges that students had. So this has just been something that people have fought for a long time. And, you know, now you've had incredible bipartisan support in an era where there's no bipartisan support.
That's true.
For allowing athletes to have these rights. And so we're finally there. So it is a massive, massive step in college athletics history.
So let me ask you this, and you brought up a couple of great points I want to address. So, I mean, one of them, obviously, you're right. I mean, we talk about the student athlete part of it. A lot of these student athletes in these lawsuits over the years have sort of made the case that, well, we're not really student athletes. We're basically like student employees, because we have to build our whole schedules around our scholarship sports team that we're participating on. And also, you brought up this example as well. You know, if you are a music prodigy, you can still go to Juilliard and get paid for a gig on the side. You can't do that in college sports. If you know, everybody always uses, I know John Calipari uses the Mark Zuckerberg example. That's one of his favorites, sort of the idea of, hey, if you were Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard, Zuckerberg ended up dropping out, but he didn't have to drop out. He could have stayed at Harvard and still run Facebook. Well, you can't do that if you're a big time college basketball player. You can't stay at Kentucky and also market yourself. So that's one I wanted to address with you. And two is, everything we've talked about certainly has been boiling over for a long time, and people have been fighting for athletes' rights. But why is this happening now? Why was July 1st sort of liberation day for NIL? Why all of a sudden have the floodgates opened?
One other quick example, because we were talking about Katie Ledecky earlier. She didn't need to leave Stanford. She could have swam collegiately if she was allowed to sign her deal with TIER, which is a Speedo competitor, and stay eligible, right? Like, so you're losing a lot of Olympic athletes. Michael Phelps didn't go to college because of this decision. He was so marketable, he would have had to give up millions of dollars. So he trained alongside athletes at Michigan, but he did not go to college because he would not have been eligible. So you have Olympic swimmers as a really good example, golf, tennis. You have a lot of athletes that have to go pro because of the marketing opportunities. So this changes the game for those pipelines as well. The reason that July 1st became the day is a couple of different factors. So the Supreme Court just ruled unanimously against the NCAA. Now, that case wasn't directly about name, image, and likeness. It was actually about what schools can provide for their athletes related to education. So it's like laptops, post-grad internship opportunities, paid internship opportunities. So that's also, by the way, a massive decision. It's very narrow and minor, but it opens up opportunities for future legal challenges. And that's basically what that, there was the opinion, and then there was the concurring opinion from Justice Brett Kavanaugh that got a ton of attention.
Yeah.
Because he was basically saying, like, there's lots of other legal parts of what the NCAA is doing. If this was any other business, we would say that this stuff was illegal.
That it violates antitrust law.
Yeah, please bring us more cases, basically. He said, like, there's other rules that, like, our problem, this was very narrow. So that happened at the end of June. Now, a lot of the reason that the NCAA didn't pass a rule change before that was there were a lot of people who wanted to wait and see what that ruling was. And in that ruling, they straight up said, hey, you're not above the law. Like, you have to follow antitrust laws like everybody else. So that impacted the way that NIL rules eventually came out, because they had to be really vague. They had to say, like, schools can make their own policies, but the NCAA couldn't straight up say, you're not allowed to do this and this and this, and just add all these restrictions just because they would have immediately been sued, right? Like, that's basically because of the Supreme Court case. And then you also had 10 states, maybe 12 ultimately at the end, saying, like, hey, we're going to allow our athletes to do this on July 1. So the NCAA had to do something for the other 30 something states, because otherwise that's just not fair. That's why they had to pass a policy, like an interim policy, the day before, so that everyone could technically be able to do this and not be ruled ineligible. But it was very chaotic, because there was a period of time for, you know, the months leading into this that there was hope there would be a federal law by now, like all these other pieces that would have kind of done the job for the NCAA. And instead it was like an 11th hour thing where the NCAA passed an interim policy because they had to sort of match all of these state laws that were about to take effect.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And there's about, you know, 20 to 24 states at this point that have passed something. Not everybody's law was set to go into effect this year, some in 2022, but that created sort of the idea that you could have maybe some competitive imbalance, right? And correct me if I'm wrong here. If the state of Georgia says their athletes who are at their universities can benefit from NIL, and then a neighboring state like South Carolina says no, then that's a huge recruiting disadvantage for South Carolina and the SEC. So that's why it seems like there's this rush by the states to pass stuff, and also a rush by the NCAA to kind of level the playing field for everyone.
Yes. And I don't think it's an accident that a lot of the states that forced this issue, that like sped up the timelines, are in the SEC.
Okay.
These are schools like Georgia signed its law at the University of Georgia football facilities. Like, these are people who absolutely do not want any potential recruiting disadvantage.
Okay.
So if Florida is passing something that's July 1, then Alabama wants to be July 1, and so does Georgia and all these other states. So then you have Ohio State being like, well, we don't want to be at a disadvantage to Georgia and Florida and Alabama. So they go, theirs was an executive order to try to get done in time. So absolutely, that's what happened. And that's why the NCAA had to do something, because you can't have like 10 states starting on a certain day and the other 40 not in recruiting for next year. All of these things, you had to have something that's sort of equal so that you don't have athletes making decisions solely based on NIL. And eventually the hope is that there will be a federal law. It'll be exactly the same for everyone in all 50 states. But right now there was that very real panic of like, well, we have to do something because our competitors are doing something. And that's obviously how college sports work. Someone finds a loophole or, you know, like a shortcut, everyone else has to do the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. If somebody can push a competitive advantage that maybe puts other schools at a disadvantage, those schools want to catch up. I mean, it's the great arms race of college sports. It's the same reason we see these elaborate, opulent football facilities being built. You know, everybody is doing the best they can to attract the best student athletes they can. I want to go back to this Supreme Court case, Alston versus the NCAA. And as you mentioned, it was narrow. It was not specifically dealing with NIL, but certainly I think the NCAA could read the tea leaves here. And I just have to say how remarkable it was that this decision was unanimous. That means 9-0. I don't think you could get these nine justices to agree unanimously on what to order for lunch, but they agreed that the NCAA's business model at least in this case, and as you mentioned with Justice Kavanaugh and his concurring opinion, really firing a broadside at the NCAA, basically saying your entire business model, the underpinnings of it, is wildly illegal and unconstitutional, and you better fix it fast.
Hating the NCAA and attacking the NCAA has brought people together unlike anything else in this era, because from a lawmaker standpoint, you had, you know, the Republican side of like free markets and wanting people capitalism to make money and what they're valuable, you know, what they can. And then you had on the Democratic side, labor, like just supporting labor and even, you know, trying to go further, right, about ideas about unionization. Some of the federal bills that have been proposed are trying to suggest that, or group licensing at the very least, right? And so it's like, you know, protecting labor. So you had both of these sides. And then the same thing shockingly happens in the Supreme Court, that it was, you know, unanimous. And it was very interesting because as someone who doesn't obviously cover a lot of Supreme Court cases, I was listening to the oral arguments back in March, and every single justice who spoke had either a really pointed question or really pointed criticism in a lead into a question. And to me, the one thing I took away from that was, oh, they get it. Like, they know how college sports works, where the bread is buttered, where the money goes. And they're not just buying into the NCAA's talking points of, like, you know, just the pageantry and the history of college sports and stuff. They seem to be pretty critical of the enterprise. So you got to feel pretty good about that. But like, to go 9-0, no. Like, I mean, my colleague at The Athletic, Andy Staples, was like, even sports fans understand like running up the score, right? Like that's what it felt like. And again, the Brett Kavanaugh concurring opinion was really interesting. And again, it's only one person's opinion.
Sure.
But the part of the one of the parts that I think was most interesting was he compared what the NCAA has argued to other industries when he was trying to point out that this would be illegal in any other industry. He said, I thought this was a really good comparison. It would be like a bunch of restaurants colluding together to decide not to pay their cooks and then claiming that they're doing that because the restaurant goers think the food is better when they know that the chefs are underpaid.
That is a like, great that
doesn't,
analogy.
Doesn't make any sense.
No,
so,
it doesn't.
So he spelled all this out. And again, I think that's part of the reason like that his opinion was going viral, because a lot of people, I think, feel this way.
So what Kavanaugh said in relation to what you just referenced about the cooks is the NCAA's business model would be flatly illegal in almost any other industry in America. All of the restaurants in a region cannot come together to cut cooks' wages on the theory that customers prefer to eat food from low-paid cooks. Law firms cannot conspire to cabin lawyer salaries in the name of providing legal services out of love of the law. Hospitals cannot agree to cap nurses' incomes in order to create a purer form of helping the sick. News organizations cannot join forces to curtail pay reporters to preserve a tradition of public-minded journalism. Movie studios cannot collude to slash benefits to camera crews to kindle a spirit of amateurism, which is just like the biggest slam dunk. Kavanaugh did not have to write a concurring opinion. And I also want to get your thoughts on this in general when it comes to what we were just talking about, like, God bless America, the Supreme Court finally agreed on something we can all come together to hate the NCAA together. Kavanaugh is a fairly new Supreme Court justice, the second to newest
yes,
the crew.
Yes, that's right.
Yep. And he was originally thought of being pro-corporation, anti-workers, anti-laborers. And also in his concurring decision, he basically talks about collective bargaining and students forming a union. So where do you see that going moving forward when it comes to potentials of collective bargaining?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different directions in the immediate short term. This has been something I've been watching with some of the proposed federal legislation, is group licensing. So the idea of jersey sales or EA Sports being able to have actual player likenesses and names on jerseys, which they're not. Like, they're bringing back a video game generically, which people are still going to be excited about.
Yeah. I mean, the video game's like a big deal. Just, can you give a little background on the video game? Because, you know, NCAA football, I played it as a kid, and like, it was a big deal when it went away, and it went away because of lawsuits filed by student athletes.
Right. So basically, you know, Ed O'Bannon was playing and watching people play the basketball version. Yes. I was like, that's me. Like, I'm not getting paid for this. That looks like me, mannerisms like me, skill set like me. And you know, that Ed O'Bannon lawsuit against the NCAA is one of the lawsuits that got this thing rolling. Alston was another one, right? And you had EA Sports basically take the game out of circulation. I think it was 2014 was the last game.
Okay.
Denard Robinson was on the cover. He was like perpetually on the cover for the last game. And again, so it was basically because the NCAA said, like, you can't do this. The NCAA argument for a while now has been that group licensing is too complicated, that it's not workable.
Okay.
If they're not unionized, and they also don't want them to unionize, right? So it's like a catch-22.
Yes.
You had the Northwestern football team, Kane Coulter, attempt to unionize back in 2015. There was a whole lot of issues. I would encourage people to read up about that, about why that one didn't work. But it's obviously notoriously very difficult to have these conversations about college sports. There were some that were prompted a little bit last summer when the pandemic was happening and college athletes had no say in any of the policies or even return to play when they had to come back to campuses, unlike their pro counterparts, because the unions were part of the negotiations of figuring out what the COVID seasons were going to look like. They didn't have that in college, and you had like smatterings of some of those players groups and kind of like putting out lists of demands. But that didn't really, you know, like amount to a full, you know, push to organize or to unionize. And that was a situation where I thought maybe it would, right? You're talking about health and safety protocols. They're not on campuses. Maybe it's easier to have those conversations when you're, you know, not in the ecosystem of college football. But so that didn't end up happening. However, group licensing is still an interesting talking point, because I think based on conversations with lawyers, there are ways to have like representation for collective bargaining without being a union. So like, it's possible that there will be representation and athletes will be able to do group licensing again at some point here, you know, with someone negotiating on behalf of the group. And again, that feels like a step towards ultimately unionization, a step towards actually having a seat at the table. A couple of the federal bills, or at least one of them, specifically has the ability, the right to organize as part of its, you know, the way that it's written. It's coming from Democratic senators. No one's anticipating that it's going to get like a ton of bipartisan support, but it is starting a conversation. It's continuing a conversation. So, you know, all of these things are things to just kind of keep on the back burner and pay attention to. And especially the Supreme Court stuff, especially Kavanaugh basically saying like, bring us more cases, because this had to be very narrow. But there's other issues, other antitrust issues that we would be open to looking at. So again, all of these things are kind of happening at the same time. NIL is a major step, but obviously, you know, if there were to be unionization down the road or actually paying athletes as employees for being athletes, like those are even more fundamental changes to the system. But you know, you have to take steps before you completely overhaul a system and make it more like a minor league system. Like, it doesn't just happen overnight.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to say, you know, just sort of as background on this, is that I think what a lot of people probably realize when they really think about it, Nicole, is that major college football, major college basketball, those are essentially minor league systems for the NFL and the NBA that they don't really have to pay for. It's free minor league systems, free development mm-hmm. systems for those two leagues. And you look at a league like MLB, which just downsize minor league baseball to save costs, but they have to subsidize minor league baseball. The NHL, they have minor leagues. That has to be subsidized to a degree. And so here's this free minor league for the NFL and the NBA, and that's what's happening here. Other minor league prospects and other sports, they get paid, because even though you're in the minors, you're a professional. You've signed a professional contract. You've turned pro. You're in the pro development pipeline. But you can't do that. You know, if you're Spencer Rattler at Oklahoma this year, even if people think you're going to be the number one pick in the NFL draft in 2022, you can't get paid for your performance on the field. And even within this NIL ruling, it still can't be tied to anything that happens performance wise, right? Like, you can't say like, we're going to pay you if you score this many touchdowns.
No, that's like, there's like three specific rules, and that's one of them.
Okay.
you can't have like a booster say, I will pay you $20,000 if you sign with Alabama.
Okay.
Like, you can't, I mean, again, there's going to be wink, wink, nudge, nudge stuff, but like, you can't specifically say that. You also can't specifically say, I will pay you $100 for every touchdown you throw.
Yeah.
Like, it can't be pay for play in terms of like, a reward or something tied to something that happens on the field. But again, like if you are, so let's say you're Trevor Lawrence and you're deciding whether or not you want to come back for your final year of eligibility. You know, if you come back, that you would have a lot of marketing opportunities, right? You know, certainly in Clemson, but you know, everywhere else or whatever it might look like. Those things are going to factor into decisions, but they're just not going to be, it's not going to be specifically like, oh, someone's going to pay Trevor Lawrence every time he throws a touchdown if he comes back. It would just be like, oh no, he'd be a mega star and he will have more opportunities. So they're related, but it's not direct.
That completely makes sense. And I just want people to sort of understand that. If you've ever watched, you know, ABC, ESPN, college football, the open of it looks like the NFL, and they even feature mm-hmm. the players. I mean, it's like, oh, here's this huge matchup. You know, let's look at Sam Howell of UNC versus De'Eriq King of Miami, two of the best quarterbacks in the nation. And you'll see them. They'll be talking to him. They'll be in the open in uniform. All this stuff you see on maybe like a Monday or Sunday night football for the NFL. But there's no ability until now for those players to market themselves. So that's why this is so huge. I wanted to ask you, do you think that the commission that Condoleezza Rice chaired, did that have anything to do with this, where it really sort of pushed the idea of a separation between the pro model and the college model? And they were sort of working together in her mind, wink, wink, against the interest of the college athlete. And you look at something like the G League, starting the G League Ignite, where they're taking some of the best high school basketball recruits and saying, don't go play college basketball for Kentucky or North Carolina or Duke. Come play for our G League Ignite team. Learn how to be a pro and you can make up to $500,000 a year. Did that push the NCAA at all on this?
I think a little bit. Basketball is the easiest sport to look at and see alternatives because it's just the 1 year minimum before you're draft eligible. Like that type of kind of real competitor doesn't exist in college football because you have to be 3 years after high school graduation until you are eligible to be drafted. So basketball has always been more ripe for these opportunities. We've also even seen athletes just decide to train in other countries or wherever, play in Europe for a year, whatever it might be, before being drafted. And that's just not going to work in some of these other sports. So it's certainly part of it in that sport. But I would say that the Condoleezza Rice thing, you know, was met by a lot of people in the industry with kind of a shrug, right? Like it wasn't really tackling the root causes of these issues and creating like an alternative summer basketball circuit and different rules around that doesn't really fix like the fundamental issues of guys wanting to get in people's ears and, you know, kind of third parties and shady agents and different things that happen in college basketball in the recruiting process. Again, because the risk and reward is like the reward is so soon. This is so different than someone investing, you know, a ton of time and money into like a 15-year-old football player because you still have to wait until they can go pro. And now, you know, in basketball, it's always been a shorter timeline. So I think there's some elements to it, but I think a lot of people were more just frustrated that like you had this FBI investigation into college hoops and nothing's really changed. I think it's more in the basketball world in terms of like how one and done works more so than necessarily pressuring on this because they could change or they could put pressure on the NBA to change the draft rules. They could also change, you know, eligibility about players not being drafted. Like you could do different things from an NCAA side. And part of those recommendations did address like allowing athletes to get a little bit more feedback directly from the NBA. So they know if they're going to be drafted or invited to the combine and different, like there were some timeline
which
things.
Just makes sense.
But ultimately again, yeah, not the root cause of what happened there about, you know, just again, enticements, nothing in that, or even in the NCAA sanctions so far has really hit on that root cause yet.
Got it. And the commission there, Ellen is telling me the Commission on College Basketball, which was chaired by former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. So
there was no one on that commission who currently worked in college basketball.
Wow. That's interesting. It's really interesting to see, you know, just sort of some of these developments here. The other thing I want to mention with NIL that maybe will be shocking to some people and what players have gotten in trouble in for the past and been declared ineligible, they can sign with agents now, but only for marketing purposes, just for marketing purposes. And this gets into the shadiness of some of these agents. You know, it does become a quid pro quo. Well, like, okay, I'll do the marketing for you, but when you go pro, you have to sign with me to represent you as a professional. That's not supposed to happen. But just the idea to me that as a major college athlete, you can now sign with an agent and it's okay and you'll still be eligible as long as it's just for marketing purposes. I never thought I'd see that day. Like, to me, that's up there with the college football playoff existing and going to 12 teams as things I never thought I'd see as a college sports fan.
Yeah, and there's some administrators who, that's the most shocking part about all of this, okay, right? That's kind of been part of the proposals all along, that they would be allowed to have professional representation. This has been a major sticking point, major concern, especially in the Power Five, about agents and influence. And obviously there's a thinking that, you know, do this above board, you know, help them, because, you know, I think a lot of people are going to, we're going to learn, right? We're going to see people sign deals that are bad, that are, you know, undervalued, you know, under market value, over market value. Like, we're going to see people make mistakes. And so I think that thinking there is, like, have people who are registered in your states do things above board and hopefully take care of the athletes, put them in a better position so they're not getting screwed. However, it's still really jarring. And you're absolutely right that we have seen NCAA violations based on this exact thing, signing with an agent or having an agent handle something before you're actually, like, no longer using your eligibility. Because this is something we talk about with, like, NFL prospects all the time. Like, a lot of them announce their agent. Like, obviously they've been talking to their agent in those months leading up. Yeah, and that exactly was against the rules. So I think even if it's like what you're saying, where it's sort of like a trial run, if someone's like, all right, I'm going to work with this agency, and if it goes well, like, I'll probably sign with them, I still think that's fine. Isn't that how a lot of us, like, kind of do jobs, right? We intern places and then kind of feel it out and decide if we want to work there, if they want to work with us. But it is jarring. And there's absolutely a lot of people still concerned about that, how that's going to work, how it's going to be kind of transparent, reported. And then even just the idea that boosters are technically allowed to be part of this, because, again, a lot of the boosters, right, are, let's say you own the local gym in town, yeah, and you also donate money to the school, you're technically a booster. There were a lot of people in Power Five recruiting circles that didn't want that to be part of it, right? But, like, the NCAA was backed into this corner on it because the Supreme Court ruling had to be very vague, had to be very broad. And so now we have this world where, like, I do think there's going to be a lot of genuine confusion. I don't think everyone's going to be trying to cut corners, but some of this stuff needs to get worked out. Like, we still don't know exactly how that agent piece is going to work and look like. We've seen a couple of things about companies and agencies that have gotten involved, but we still don't know. And so that's going to be, again, another adjustment. And some of these things are things that people who worked in college sports for decades said would, like, never happen. These were, like, the word agent, like, things like this were things that no one wanted to even think about being part of the collegiate model. And now here we are.
Nicole, correct me if I'm wrong, but when I read the part about having an agent, I thought about it much more from, like, a social media point of view, where it's a lot of these athletes are not going to go pro. They're not going to go to the Olympics. They're, you know, this is the end of the road for them, but they have a very large social media following and they're not able to have a talent representation the way that other influencers in a way would. Is that not the case? I thought it had much more to do with monetizing their social media streams.
It's all of it. It's somewhat professional representation to set up a billboard deal with a company. It is for, yes, a talent rep for social media to set up some influencer deals. It includes all of that. It just has to be directly related to NIL opportunities. So it's all of the above. I think some of this you'll see, like, individual agents. I think some of it you'll see, like, some of those, the marketing arms of different agencies, like, maybe you just work with, like, the whole kind of marketing firm. But it's going to be all of those types of things, which, again, like, they would not have had the opportunity to do if this wasn't, like, specifically outlined as allowable.
So I think one of the fears, and it's interesting, I want to jump off Ellen's point there about, you know, social media and how that plays a role in being able to market some of these athletes. Because I think one of the fears when this was done was that, okay, NIL is great, and we've talked about the video games, but there's no, like, women's swimming video game from EA, you know? So it was like, okay, this will only further the disparity between the quote-unquote revenue sports and then the quote-unquote non-revenue sports, which are usually sort of Olympic sports, you know, tennis, swimming, golf, stuff like that. But I thought it was really interesting that when this opened up, you know, one of the athletes who's been able to take advantage of it the most is LSU gymnast Olivia Dunn. And she has 3.9 million TikTok followers and 1.1 million followers on Instagram. And there was something done basically showcasing her and her social media account in Times Square. Now, she's a gymnast for LSU. However, she was not part of the 24-member All-SEC team. And so she's not the best gymnast for LSU, but she's a very popular gymnast. And so I'm just curious for your feelings on that, both from the idea, do you think there is something to the idea there's a disadvantage for the non-revenue sports people here, or is it more like the examples you raised before with Michael Phelps? And how does it play in the college sports world that maybe the people who will benefit the most from NIL are not always the most accomplished performers or student athletes or the people who are at the best in their field?
So one, we'll just start by saying, exactly to your point, there's going to be opportunities for female athletes. And this is something I've been trying to stress for months, because people have just been talking about this as if it was only going to be the Alabama quarterback that had opportunities. And we have already seen what I predicted was you have a lot of female athletes in gymnastics, particularly the gymternet is insane. People are very loyal.
I've never heard that term, dedicated. The gymternet.
Oh yeah. That's what they call themselves.
Wow. Like, okay.
The gymternet.
Okay.
Women's volleyball, women's basketball. There are athletes in these sports that have huge, huge social media followings. So they're going to have opportunities. 1 million Instagram followers puts you in a certain tier of like influencing opportunities that you'll see. You saw there were a number of athletes. I saw at least Nebraska as well. And I think some athletes on the West Coast doing merch. Like they were selling merchandise at midnight on July 1. Like there's going to be a lot of opportunities in addition to camps and lessons that these female athletes will be able to cash in on. The point about maybe not being the best player on the team is a really interesting one, because we have seen that. We have seen cult-like heroes emerge who are not the best players on the team. I always think about Mark Titus, who's Club Trillion. So he became a huge deal. He had a blog when he was at Ohio State, and it was Club Trillion because you would play, if you were lucky and your team was up by a lot, you'd play for 1 minute and then have zeros in the rest of the stat line. So
I get it. That's pretty cool.
So he was like the last guy on the bench, and he had this blog kind of like poking behind the scenes of like what it was like to play with Evan Turner and a bunch of different teammates. And he was a walk-on, but he was so popular, and the blog was really, really popular, and he had a lot of Twitter followers. And, you know, this was like 2010 or whatever. I did a story last summer looking at the social media followings and kind of like trying to evaluate. And I made this point that there might be a walk-on kicker at some of these teams that really wants to be in like the day in a life YouTube space and can do like paid commercials for the, you know, whatever you do, paid YouTube channel and you have ads. And so there will be people who like just put a lot of energy into something or are really like personable, have a great personality that draw people to them that don't play a lot. And I talked to Mark Titus about if he had any sense. I said to him, do you have any sense like how valuable you were when you were at Ohio State? And he said, yeah, I do actually, because we sold t-shirts and we had to donate it for charity.
Oh, wow.
And so he had an exact dollar figure. It was like $50,000 worth of t-shirt sales in a couple of months. And it had to go to charity, and they had to kind of like fund all this stuff. And he was actually really funny. He said like the guys at the charity like continually call him sometimes. They're like, I can't believe you did that. He's like, I would have liked to keep the money, but I couldn't. So, you know, it had to go to you. But this was like years ago. This was, you know, before Instagram, and, you know, he didn't have a YouTube channel, like all these different things. He didn't play, and he was really marketable. And so I think that that's a really good example to keep in the back of your mind of what this is going to look like, because it's not just going to be the star players, and it's not just going to be star men's athletes.
So let me ask you this, and I want to ask both you and Ellen this, as females who are accomplished in your field, do you have any concern that some of the athletes who are able to promote themselves, the female ones, that they will be viewed as marketable for their aesthetic value and not their athletic value?
Am I worried about it?
Yeah.
No. Like at the end of the day, glory of playing a college sport doesn't pay the bills. And like if a talent agency reaches out to you because you can model clothes or model some sort of athletic wear, that really I don't see on like a social media platform space is any different than what guys will be doing. Like they will be asked, maybe they'll be asked to model a watch instead of a bathing suit, but they're both going to basically be billboards for a brand. And if women can make a career out of their college experience in a way that they've never been able to before, I think that's an incredible opportunity.
Yeah. And I would just say, Nicole, I ask you that question as well, just because I know, you know, you are in the journalism field, obviously, and you're also covering sports, and you know better certainly than I do that there still is a fight going on for female athletes. I look at the WNBA, you know, to be judged as athletes, to be judged on their athletic ability and their accomplishments and how good they are at their sport. And so while I think this is a wonderful opportunity, I do think the question, and I know Pat Forty, who we both know, has sort of raised this as well, the idea of, okay, you know, are we going to see people basing this on traditional concepts of attractiveness? Those will be some of the most marketable athletes. Or is it, you know, a tremendous college basketball player? Will she be someone who is able to market herself? So that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Ellen. It's exactly the same as anything else. It's the same as the professional sports. And the athletes who are more conventionally attractive in both genders tend to have more opportunities,
Tom
right?
Brady.
Like, it's part of the reason I was just going to say, it's part of the reason that Tom Brady is, you know, able to command so many marketing dollars just because he's won a lot. I mean, sure, that's a big part of it, but is it also because he's incredibly attractive and conventionally attractive? So he can do an ad for UGG or UGGs or whoever, and it looks like a model? Yes, like that's going to be part of it. And that's part of anything. And, you know, as someone who's followed, you know, I follow fitness influencers and beauty influencers and fashion influencers, it's all the same, right? It's all about, yes, there's going to be some people who are not as conventionally attractive as everyone else, but so much of this mirrors modeling and advertisements in general. And I do think, like, as an industry, you know, we're starting to see like the way that these, you know, magazines are picking cover models and things are looking a lot different. And hopefully people are getting,
yes,
you know, trying to have like their, you know, images look more like regular people. And I do think it's going to be similar on the men's side. I mean, when we think about the most marketable male athletes, a lot of them are conventionally attractive. It's funny you brought up Pat, because I remember at the London Olympics, he was making fun of himself because his most read column was about Ryan Lochte and his sex appeal. Like, that was the most read thing. So, like, it happens on both sides.
That's a great
here.
Point.
And again, like, there's a part of the reason that, like, certain male athletes have been so marketable, right? So, again, I'm not concerned about it. I think everyone, if there's a market for you to cash in on something, you will do it. And again, Katie Ledecky, if she was able to stay at Stanford, still would have commanded however many millions of dollars she just got from Tier, but would have been able to, you know, be at Stanford. And that's not someone who's ever played into sex appeal or anything. And I think that some of the, you know, language around some of that is a little bit paternalistic, being like, oh, it's only going to be the good looking girls who, no, like, let's just let it play out. Again, these were all the same people who 3 weeks ago were saying, you know, women weren't going to be getting any money in NIL, right? Like, stop, keep moving the goalposts and let's see how this works out. But like, if it's reflective of, you know, where advertising money goes today, like, I don't understand how that's necessarily a bad thing, or at the very least, it's not surprising.
Also, I will say, like, in social media, it is one of the few spaces where women are actually in control of their own images. And mm-hmm. So if a woman isn't comfortable with being sexual or sexualized in that manner, then they don't have to be. It's not someone putting that image on them. It's them choosing to work with a brand who is portraying the image they want to have.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I can say, you know, as an African-American, that I was heartened to see that one of the first NIL agreement signed was by Jackson State football player Antoine Owens. He signed an endorsement contract with a hair care product 12:01 a.m. on July 1st, because another fear I think a lot of people had was that some of the historically black colleges and universities would be left behind, that some of those athletes mm-hmm. would not be able to get these endorsement deals. And for Antoine to sign that, I think that's heartening as well. So hopefully this will help a wide, wide spectrum of athletes who compete under the NCAA umbrella. I want to ask you about this, Nicole, because we're mentioning the NCAA, and you've referenced several times, I think it's sort of seen as the evil empire, certainly one of the easier organizations to detest or rail against. We know how much money is involved in the NCAA men's basketball tournament, what's going on with the college football playoff, which is, you know, technically not the NCAA, but it's NCAA schools. But there are also people that really do enjoy the current model, that they do buy into the amateurism trope, I would say. Most of those people, I think, are older than the three of us, but there are people who like that. And one of those people, I'm going to give a shout out here to our old boss, Joe Sullivan, the former sports editor of the Boston Globe. Joe's moved a little bit, but he really likes the amateur element of the NCAA and wants it to stay the same. So what do you say to people like Joe?
I think it's it's kind of a compromise. Like, it's not, these are not employees. They're still getting to compete. The main thing I say is to think about the Olympic model, because the Olympics went through this exact thing in the 70s. And great again, point. Part of the concern was like, are people going to feel as attached to the athletes? You know what? Like when they jump in the pool or Simone Biles gets ready to compete, like we all feel our patriotism. Like we all are like, yes, like Team USA. We want, you know, like we're not thinking, oh man, Simone Biles has like makes millions of dollars from Uber Eats. Like, oh, do I pull for her as much? Like, no, like we don't think about that. You're still going to have your attachment to your college programs. And I think it's very different. As someone who grew up in a pro sports area, grew up outside of New York, and then went to Michigan and now cover college sports, like I think it's very different. The level of attachment, you've probably spent a lot of money at these schools, and you've spent formative years and lived in these towns. It's not going to go away overnight. And I don't think it's going to go away. I don't think anyone's going to be thinking about this when they're watching a game and their favorite athlete does something, right? Like, and I think there are a lot of people who really genuinely care for the college athletics mission. I think there's a lot of administrators who really got involved in this because they want to make sure that there's opportunities for female athletes and Olympic sport athletes and want all of these things. And there's a lot of administrators, again, I think there's a little bit of a generational gap, our age, who are very pro NIL, pro all these opportunities, want to make it work. And then there's older ones who, again, have fought back against it, but now are whatever, like this is the new world. This is how it works. So it's really just, you know, you can still have all those things. You can still preserve what we love about it, the traditions and these things, while feeling a little bit better because the athletes are getting a cut of it during their most marketable years. And I also think Johnny Manziel was a really big turning point in this because he was penalized for selling his own autograph. And I think a lot of people were like, why is that a big deal? Why are we all worked up about this? And you started to see a shift there, even in terms of like media organizations stop doing the NCAA's work for them and writing these stories about NCAA violations, which aren't real violations. They were not like breaking the law. There was this whole shift from a public opinion standpoint as well. So I think that even the people who were like really love, you know, kind of the heyday of college sports or like how pure it was in the 80s and 90s understand that the money has changed. I think ultimately, like, it's going to be one of those things where like, we're going to still watch the games. You're still going to feel the same way we do about the teams, just like we do with the Olympics.
Yeah, I think the Olympics, I think that's a great parallel. I think in a lot of ways for a lot of people, Nicole, it's like going to a movie. It's sort of like the willful suspension of disbelief. You know, let's be honest, athletes have been getting compensated, not all of them, and certainly not fairly, but behind the scenes for years. That's where you have these booster scandals. You hear these stories about, somebody opens their drawer and there's $100 in there, or the legendary story about Eric Dickerson when he goes to SMU, suddenly in his driveway, there's a gold, I think it was a Camaro or a Trans Am or something. So that's been going on. So the idea that people were not getting compensated, like I said, it's like going to an action movie and believing that The Rock can actually scale this skyscraper. It's been the willful suspension of disbelief.
No,
maybe The Rock can. Speaking of former college athletes. And also another point, I'm glad you brought up Johnny Manziel, because I think that brings up this point too that I want to mention and that we've talked about. Look, for some of these people who are college athletes, regardless of the sport, their most marketable years might be while they're in college. Like for Johnny Manziel, he was never more popular than when he was, you know, Johnny Heisman and Johnny Football at Texas A&M. So he lost out on a lot of money. I think a guy like Tyler Hansbrough, he lost out on a lot of money. Your Katie Ledecky example. And there's countless other ones. You know, I remember back in the day, the figure skater Debbie Thomas, you know, she had to make that choice with the Olympics. So there's so many people where it's like your most marketable years might be while you're still in college, and you should be able to take advantage of that. That's the American way. That's capitalism. If you live in a capitalistic society, then you should be able to capitalize on that stuff. So I think that when you look at it from that standpoint, in fairness, I think that really this is progress. And I hope that a lot of people who don't even agree with it will look at it and say, okay, it's progress. I want to wrap it up with you on this point, because we've talked so much about the sea change in the NCAA. It's not just NIL, it's other things. I know there are other cases out there. I want to ask you this. Is the NCAA model, as it currently exists, around 10 years from now? Is the NCAA still the governing body of college sports?
It's a really good question. I don't have an answer to that, because I think you have seen a lot of examples in the last couple of years in particular, where what is the point of having this organization if they're not able to lead during the pandemic. They're not able to actually decide whether or not college football can be played. Like, they were basically putting out health recommendations and that was it. It was up to conferences. So the fact that college football is basically out of the NCAA purview is already an issue because, you know, like you mentioned, the college football playoff runs itself. It's got relationships directly with conferences, and the NCAA doesn't, by not controlling its postseason, it was not able to control its regular season during the pandemic. So you already have that element. You always have these threats for the Power Five to split off from the rest of college sports. But the basketball tournament has been so lucrative. The men's basketball tournament has been so lucrative, and people understand the need for the Davids if you're going to have the Goliaths. So that hasn't happened, but that's always kind of like an existential threat that there is a split, right, in Division One. I think, too, you know, there's a lot of people who are really disillusioned with NCAA President Mark Emmert right now. They don't understand why he got a contract extension through 2025. Him and his right-hand man's legal strategy, which they just lost unanimously to the Supreme Court. They ruled against the NCAA. It was their legal strategy. And they were the ones that appealed the decision that went up to the Supreme Court, which backfired on them. He also has been the person who has been lobbying Congress and asking for federal intervention on NIL, which didn't come before the state's deadlines were. And still hasn't, you know, again, you ended up with the exact scenario that the NCAA didn't want, which is like a patchwork of different rules and different laws in different places throughout the country. So that was not great leadership either from Mark Emmert or from the NCAA setting a national standard. They didn't do that. So when you look at like kind of these fundamental questions of like, what would a national governing body accomplish? What would be the goals of it? They're not meeting those. So that's why you have people saying like, is this an outdated, antiquated system? It's set up where like the highest governing bodies involve university presidents. Are they able to be well-versed enough in sports to be making these decisions about Mark Emmert's job status and about name, image, and likeness and acting quickly and making these decisions as a membership, you know, association with over 1,000 members, and divisions 1, 2, and 3 are all under the same umbrella when they all look and work very differently. So there's kind of these just fundamental questions about that. And then again, if you do eventually get to a model where athletes are, you know, have union representation, what would that look like? Like, I think it's a very real question. I don't have a great answer to it, but here are the reasons that people are having those questions about the NCAA as an entity, not just to take shots at it, but to realistically look at like, what does an organization like that serve? What do they do? What can they lead on? What can they accomplish? And are they meeting those standards? And I think there's a lot of people within the system that have been really, really frustrated on, again, the pandemic, NIL, the legal strategy, all these really major topics. And that's why you have those doubts about, you know, what this organization looks like and its leadership 5 years out from now, 10 years out from now.
Yeah, I think the NCAA, my opinion, it will still exist, but I think it will be unrecognizable. They're going to have to change the business model like any business. When you start to see changes in society, changes in the economy, they're going to have to adapt to survive. So maybe it will still be the NCAA, but I don't think it will be recognizable to us. Certainly the future of the face of college sports is really fascinating, and what's happening right now, I think it continues to evolve, and I'm really excited to sort of see where we end up. No one better to talk about this with than Nicole Auerbach of The Athletic. Nicole, thanks for taking the time with us today on the Take Five podcast and educating us on these really complicated and really fascinating issues in college sports.
Absolutely. Anytime, my friend.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Take Five podcast. We appreciate it as always. Don't forget to subscribe and rate the podcast so others can find it and enjoy it. And now you can email us at take5@wcvb.com. We'd love to get your feedback and hear your thoughts. We'll catch you next time.